Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, is what I choose to call home, glistening like a jewel in the South Pacific, just far enough away from Fukushima that when you go outside and soak up the rays, it's beneficial for your tan lines, especially when you're wearing board shorts in the winter. My very special guest is the, I think now, leader of the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party, Julian Crawford. Did I get that fact right, Julian?
That's right, Vinny. Thanks for having me on the show. Yes, I took over as the leader of the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party just at the end of last year.
I've been involved heavily in the Cannabis Party. In fact, right now, within my view, is an Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party vote badge that was given to me during one of the election campaigns. I did all the video work for Michael Appleby and Kevin O'Connell, who were the president and, I think, Auckland Central candidate at the time. And one thing that, it's funny we should actually be interviewing you today, because two things. I was looking back at all my old videos, and one struck out was this video with Kevin O'Connell, where we go through politically, economically, socially, basically the whole spectrum upon the political spectrum of the effects of legalized cannabis policy. And it looks like, shoot, it's going to save the country. But very few people saw the video. It wasn't produced very well. It was earlier back in the day, shot at the daiquiri before it became even before that even became nice.
Yeah, oh, it's an amazing issue, the cannabis issue, and you know, a lot of people wonder why our political party is just a single policy party. But like you say, when you sit down and you look at all the positive impacts across society from legalizing cannabis, it impacts almost every government department. You know, we want to have people speaking out as our spokespeople on every government portfolio and saying this is a multi-issue party derived from this one plant.
So have you got an environment spokesperson and a climate change spokesperson, energy minister, etc.?
Yeah, we do have environment spokespeople, and you know, we're in the process of appointing some of our spokespeople at the moment, but as you'll be aware, industrial hemp is hugely beneficial to the environment. We're talking about hempcrete houses, which are, you know, extremely eco-friendly, well-insulated, warm, dry housing. Talking about hemp food, which is the most nutritional food you can get from any plant. And we're talking about biofuels from hemp, and you know, they say that there's at least 10,000 different uses for the hemp plant.
I heard up to 50,000.
Yeah, some people say 50,000. It's amazing what you can do with hemp. And
well, interesting, because let's take that as it were. Let's say there's roughly 50,000 uses, and that's just what's been discovered while it's illegal.
Yeah, well, a lot of that stuff was discovered before it got made illegal, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago. But imagine what we could achieve now with modern technology if we actually had our top researchers looking into hemp. There's plenty more uses that haven't been discovered. We're seeing hemp being used to develop plastics and polymers, and it's possible that in the future carbon fiber could be derived from hemp, because there's a lot of carbon locked up in the hemp plant that could be turned into these plastic composite materials.
It'll probably be taxed because it's carbon, it's terrible, it's dangerous.
Oh yeah, I mean, we're seeing all this talk about carbon, and I think it's exaggerated, the fact that carbon's going to destroy the planet. But hemp is the best thing we could be using to lock up this carbon. I mean, I don't think we should be polluting the planet unnecessarily.
Yeah, see, it's the precautionary principle. Even if hemp couldn't save the world, it could still really help, you know, like really help in pretty much every single facet of your daily life. I mean, I'm looking at these hemp cars, right? Car paneling. So it boggles the mind why I'm sitting in an office with a computer and a desk and a television and all and so forth. It could all, quite literally, my curtains, ceiling, pictures on the wall included, be made of 100% hemp, more or less, apart from cables, etc., hooking up the electronic equipment and the devices.
Yeah, I mean, we could be making all of our plastic products, all of our paper, all our clothing, you know, literally.
Wait a second, Julian, do you know what we currently make all of that stuff from now? Fossil fuels.
That's right. So chemicals, and that's the industry that has really led to the prohibition of hemp. You know, over 70 or 80 years ago, these vested interests have been coming in saying, we don't want hemp on the scene. Too much competition for the petrochemical industry.
Well, people have been talking about all sorts of competitors have been squeezing cannabis out of the market and trying to finance people to keep it illegal. I mean, I heard an allegation that Peter Dunne, the chief prohibitionist of New Zealand, was getting financed by tobacco companies, if I'm not mistaken. Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of that as a rumour. I don't have any solid facts to back it up, but it wouldn't surprise me if he was getting kickbacks from alcohol and tobacco, gambling. Who knows, you know, what these ministers are actually getting up to. Like I say, I don't have any solid evidence, but I've heard that rumour before.
Is it not an interesting tangent? Because when you think about the prohibition of cannabis, naturally, you must include, if you want to be responsible, the corruption of the people who are enforcing the prohibition of cannabis and renewing its policy.
Yeah, well, you have to be very careful when you're prohibiting a drug that you don't end up with the black market, with the criminal gangs actually colluding with the politicians. And I think there's many instances where the laws that the politicians have put in place for drugs have actually really benefited gangs. And
can you just define for the audience, what is the difference between a political party and a criminal gang?
Well, a political party has to have at least 500 members in it. But yeah, I guess a
other
gang,
than that.
Well, I mean, even political parties have sergeant at arms and, you know, similar positions to gangs, but I guess gangs are just more marginalised people who don't fit in anywhere in society. And I mean,
it seems that politicians are like career politicians. They don't fit in society anywhere. None of them have ever had a real job before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sure some of these politicians are quite corrupt and end up sort of associating with people who are in the black market trade, but, you know, that's just rumour as well. I mean, they cover their tracks.
Anyway, back on topic. We were talking about the production of hempcrete homes, and we're talking about this sustainability, this green environmentalism kind of stuff. And I've been looking into it, and I wanted to know what the Legalized Cannabis Party's position was on the implementation of Agenda 21 to save the environment and kill off humanity. If you know anything about that at all, if not,
yeah, I do. I mean, we're absolutely opposed to Agenda 21, and I was quite shocked to see that our colleagues in the Green Party are embracing Agenda 21. I think it's a disastrous idea, particularly because it's coming on a global scale. So it's really undermining New Zealand's sovereignty if we have some sort of globalist government telling us what to do. I'd much rather see New Zealand have strong national sovereignty and the citizens having individual sovereignty.
Well, Agenda 21, I think one of the end goals is to eventually do away entirely with national sovereignty. It won't exist anymore. There won't be any countries.
Yes, obviously a globalist plan. And, you know, talking about the Green Party, this is a party that has pretended that it's the voice of the cannabis movement for years. It's been parading itself as pro-cannabis, even though it's only talking about decriminalisation. It's only a low priority. But at the same time, they are saying we should be implementing UN international law in New Zealand, and it's the UN who's actually behind cannabis prohibition. So it's quite contradictory to promote globalism at the same time as saying you're going to legalise cannabis, because cannabis would already be legal in New Zealand if it wasn't for the UN single convention on narcotics.
And is it not also kind of hypocritical to be trying to implement Agenda 21 globalism whilst at the same time opposing Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement globalism?
Yeah, I think it is quite contradictory. It's quite ironic, really, that these people on the left are kicking up a big stink about the TPP. I mean, I don't support the TPP either. But, you know, I don't support a global government either. You know, it seems to be a bit contradictory that you've got the likes of Kennedy Graham in the Green Party, who's worked at the United Nations University, and he's come back to New Zealand to work on the so-called global governance project. I'm not a big fan of that, because I think that once you have a global government, it could easily lead to tyranny on a mass scale.
An irresistible tyranny. Now, politics to me is like boxing. You've got to look out for the right jab and the left hook.
Yeah. You've got, you know, these two wings, but it's a bit of a false dichotomy if you get sucked into either one of the two extremes.
Yeah, that's why you've got to have your guard up, all right? And the analogy goes through to that, and when it comes to politicking, it is imperative when choosing the people you vote for to actually know a little bit about them and what they're pushing, where they come from, that kind of thing. So I wanted to know from you, Julian. I know kind of what you're pushing. I've seen many of your comments on Facebook. Basically, you think in most ways a lot like I do, reasonably and logically. And not afraid to speak out the truth. What produced this individual is what I'm curious about.
Yeah, well, I've been interested in politics since I was young, and I studied politics at university, and I've wanted to always just understand more about how the system as a whole is functioning, how the whole thing operates. And, you know, I used to be in the Green Party when I was younger. I think there's a saying, you know, you'll be a, you know, many people are a socialist by 20 and a capitalist by 30. And I sort of started out, you know, considering myself as a socialist greenie when I was younger, but I sort of rapidly became disillusioned with the Green Party when I saw that they were willing to compromise on their principles. And particularly with the GMO, the genetically modified organisms, We used to campaign against GMOs, but then when the pressure really went on in Parliament and, you know, the Greens were getting isolated, they, you know, quickly flip-flopped on that issue and, you know, made GE-free a low priority. And then the Greens did the same with the cannabis issue. They basically said this is our lowest priority now because we don't want to have all this publicity around dope and that. So I tried to find other parties that, you know, were more willing to stick to their principles. And then I became interested in libertarianism as well and was following the Ron Paul campaign a few years back when he was going for president. So I sort of moved more towards the right. And then I guess you could say I'm pretty much in the centre now because I like to get the best ideas from the left and the right wing.
Like a Gandhi Milton Friedman.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, capitalism has its opportunities for people to, you know, pick themselves up and use free enterprise to work their way up. But there's always going to be people at the bottom of the heap that we don't want to, you know, leave them just suffering. We need to have some sort of safety net as well.
Well, you know, I think the fact that everybody's taxed X amount of their income in one form or another to the point where I think, who was it? I think it was Will Ryan from Affordable Auckland said at one point that we're paying up to 60% in tax of one form or another on all of our income. And they don't do it all in one because I think the government and taxation officials know that if they were taxing 60% of your income straight away, you'd know you're a slave.
Yeah, it's crazy that, you know, there's so many fees out there that we're expected to pay to fund the government's activities, and the government's becoming bigger and bigger, you know, and costing more and more money to run. And it's not just that we're funding it with our tax, but that's actually a collateral against a huge loan. So all the people in New Zealand that are paying tax, that's just to pay the interest on a big debt that the government is borrowing. So it really is like being on a treadmill, and you know, the more tax you pay, you know, the more you're going to have to just keep working to keep paying it.
Well, it would be an interesting one. If the government could provide stuff for free, it should be something that the person getting the free stuff would have to meet halfway. Like, let's take hemp and New Zealand housing, for example. New Zealand houses are freaking cold, man. Like, they're cold. Okay, people in Calgary, Canada, and things like that, they think they know the cold. Okay, when you go inside, you've got things like insulation, central heating, double glazing. That keeps the cold out of your house. In New Zealand, the cold follows you in, and it doesn't leave. All right, that's kind of the difference. And now the government has been doing a large insulation campaign, a huge one. They've been chucking millions and millions and millions of dollars into it. Now, you can make good quality insulation from hemp, can't you? What if hemp was legal? What if anybody could go to the government and say, hey, look, I'm going to grow some hemp plants in my backyard in accordance with a government proposal that if you bring your hemp material to the government, we'll spin it into insulation for you. And you can get somebody to install it, you know. If we meet you halfway, everybody can grow a plant out of nothing, solve certain problems around their homes. No heating costs would increase, etc. You see benefits that reproduce themselves when you introduce a voluntaristic kind of meet you halfway response rather than I'm going to forcibly take something off of you and give you something back if you're lucky.
Yeah. I mean, hemp is actually legal in New Zealand. It's just that it's over-regulated. There's a huge amount of bureaucracy and red tape that you have to go through to grow hemp. On top of that, there's a $500 license fee. There's a $750 testing fee. So you're looking at least $1,000 or more just to get the paperwork done. And at the same time, there's no one really helping people or educating people of how to get the hemp license. When you say the government could meet people halfway, if there was some sort of subsidy scheme to help people get this stuff growing, and like you say, to actually have the machinery there to process it as well would be huge, because we've seen some hemp growers grow a whole lot of hemp and then not even be able to do anything with it because we haven't had the appropriate machinery in New Zealand. So there's plenty of opportunities for developing the hemp industry and bringing investment in to build up machinery. And if we could share the machines between the different hemp farms, we could easily be producing the home insulation here and also producing the hempcrete, the lightweight concrete from hemp. And that has really good insulation properties. We could be retrofitting houses with, you know, walls 1 or 2 foot thick, you know, really big thick walls that are going to boost the insulation capacity of our homes.
Yeah, it occurs to me that these kind of machines could be quite mobile, really. I mean, hemp could be grown all over the country, and you just have a series of truck and trailer kind of guys who just turn up on a farm. They're only needed once in a while, you know, during harvest time to shred everything into usable material, you know, that kind of thing. Should be right.
For sure. I mean, there's opportunity for that to happen, but yeah, we're not seeing any help from the government. Like you say, the government is just charging us money for all of these services. They're not actually promoting the things that are actually going to make the economy better. They're very cautious about hemp. They want to keep it under control.
Well, that would be the same underpinning of the wealthy in this country, because I found that if the wealthy people of New Zealand want to do something, it gets done, kind of thing. But if there's a stigma attached to it, a social stigma, like with cannabis, you know, people will say hemp, but other people just think cannabis anyway, because the brainwashing is that freaking deep. Oh, God. Just give me a second to reel from the brainwashing about cannabis and all these people who tell me that it's going to make me have sex with black women and murder people in my sleep. Sweet, sweet mother of mercy, the brainwashing is bad. But anyway, I'm sorry, I'm ranting. Go ahead.
But, interesting you mention rich people there, because Avatar director James Cameron, he actually grows hemp up in Wairarapa. So, you know, he's probably doing it quite successfully because he can obviously afford all the infrastructure. But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't have the money to set up all the stuff they need. And, you know, we could have a collaborative effort.
Bro, we should go check out Jim Cameron's crop, man. And you know, get him to endorse ALCP just so we can get a hemp. You know, somebody famous behind the movement, man. Invigorate.
It would be great, yeah. Any celebrities out there listening to the Vinnie Eastwood show, if you want to endorse the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party, that would be great, especially James Cameron. And, you know, obviously we've got the election campaign coming up, so if we could get some celebrity candidates, that would be huge.
I'm going to attempt to keep it, like, professional and whatnot, like, really reinvigorate and re-envision ALCP, because at the end of the day, the Greens, through their we're going to decriminalise cannabis policy, haven't done squat. And United Future blocks anybody who doesn't do nothing. You know, that's the problem. So you've got the Greens leeching the votes from ALCP. You've got a grandiose plant which can more or less change the entire direction of the country and make it a world leader in a number of industries, if not nearly every industry that currently exists on planet freaking Earth. And it's being blocked by people who currently control those industries of Earth.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that Peter Dunn has specifically made an agreement with the government for the last 12 years to make sure that no legislation is introduced to legalise cannabis for recreational use. And, you know, successive Labor and National governments have agreed to that agreement, while at the same time the pro-cannabis lobby has been completely neutralised by being, splitting their support off to the Greens. And, we've ended up with a very prohibitionist situation in New Zealand where there's been very little progress on the cannabis issue. But the good thing about the ALCP is that we have reinvigorated the party. We've got a bunch of new personnel running the executive. We've got a lot more enthusiasm in the party now, and unlike other groups, we're focusing not just on the drug, the cannabis drug for recreational use, but also on the medical benefits and the industrial hemp uses. So we've got a very broad approach to the cannabis issue.
Indeed. Julian Crawford from the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party is my guest. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We are sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn. You can check out the banner on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com homepage there. Also, Blue Shield, these little EMF protection devices. I got one of them, and when I unplug it, I get headaches for a week. There's something going on with the EMF frequencies, and this thing does something to it and stops it from happening to me. I found it very interesting when you take it away. Anyway, we'll be right back, and we'll see you in just a few moments at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere. Show. It's the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. My very special guest is Julian Crawford from the ALCP, that is the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party. And what's your website? Is that still alcp.org.nz?
Yep, that's right, alcp.org.nz.
I got it. Sativex is a extract of cannabis that is really good and has a lot of medical benefits. And it's grown by a massive pharmaceutical company with a special exception to grow really, really good weed under lights legally. And then they charge it out to people who are dying at $500 like a week.
Yeah, it's a really sad situation with Sativex, because obviously it's great that there is a company that's allowed to grow this, but the fact that they're given a monopoly and they're a pharmaceutical company and no one else is allowed to compete with them, and then they're trying to charge hundreds of dollars for each dose, it really means that only 4 New Zealanders are actually using Sativex at the moment. So that's the only medical marijuana product currently approved in New Zealand.
It's not true. There is also a clause where you can get cannabis from a medical doctor to smoke or whatever via prescription, and the doctor has to apply for the prescription for you to the government, and then the government has to approve the prescription. And since cannabis was made illegal, not a single prescription has been approved.
That's right. there is provision in the existing law to allow medical marijuana. The only thing holding it back is it needs ministerial approval. So if Tony Ryle or whoever is the Minister of Health at the time just signs off on it, medical marijuana could be legal straight away without even changing the law. And doctors are allowed to prescribe cannabis, but as long as the prescription can be obtained from a legal source. And at the moment, there's no legal suppliers of cannabis. Now, there's a license. You can actually apply to the Ministry of Health and say that you want to grow cannabis for medical purposes, but generally people are not being given permission to just grow cannabis. It comes back to the situation where they actually favour the pharmaceutical companies like Sativex. That allows the Minister Peter Dunn to say, look, we've got an option available for patients. We don't need them using the raw plant material. They can use the standardised dose of Sativex. But the reality that only four people are using it is, you know, he's using Sativex to block any further development of the medical marijuana industry.
It's a dog and pony show. Here, look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this.
So, yeah, I mean, we'd like to see some New Zealand-based producers of medical marijuana, and the Ministry of Health has said they don't want people smoking it, and they don't. They would like it to be in a standardised dose, but there's no reason why that can't be done with New Zealand-based suppliers. We've got the expertise here of people who know how to grow cannabis, but they're treated like criminals.
Well, that's because technically they are. And that's the problem. Does anybody notice the connection? This is something that Kevin O'Connell said in the election that I covered all those years ago. There's a connection between crime and criminalisation.
Well, if you sort of take a chunk of society and say you're a criminal and that you have to associate with criminals to buy that product, then, you know, when you go to buy your cannabis, you could be offered pee, you know, or you could be, you know, offered a place in a gang, or, you know, you're just going to rub shoulders with undesirable people because of the criminalisation of cannabis.
If something's criminalised, the people who are willing to get involved and take control are criminals. But in general, the people who want to be involved aren't criminals, like in the traditional sense of the word. They're not going out there violently haranguing people, you know, grievous bodily harm. That's not a stoner activity, you know. Stoner activity is consuming too much junk food or playing music and some really weird riffs or some stuff or you know. There's all sorts of peaceful and creative things that stoners do. And social things. Violence, criminality, not generally one of them, unless a criminal element is involved in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, your average stoner is not interested in breaking the law. I mean, they would be otherwise law-abiding, apart from the cannabis law. But when you have gangs getting involved in the selling and the production of cannabis, then there's a very good chance that they're going to do harm to society, you know, using standover tactics, stealing people's weed or, you know, what have you. There is definitely an organised crime element that is benefiting from cannabis prohibition being in place.
Who says the organised crime element and the people who make that element a crime ain't working together or have a mutually beneficial arrangement?
Well, that's quite possible. We've seen in New Zealand with the Whānau Ora funding that some gangs have been able to get funding for Whānau Ora, where they pretend to be reformed gang members and they want to start up a group against violence. And then they get funding from the government for their anti-violence group, and then they go and spend it on marijuana and sell it at the tinny shop. So there are instances of the taxpayer funding gangs to buy pounds.
Although technically that did make people less violent because they had weed.
Yeah, well, I mean, these gangs would probably be a lot worse if they weren't stoned all the time, you know.
Hey, you know, see, the, in fact, we had a discussion with, I think he might have been a senior detective, in fact. The cannabis was on the side of the road protesting on Queen Street. And we had a sign there that said, end the drug war. And the detective said, you should have a sign that says, end the drug war, wipe out the gangs.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to bring the cannabis market right out into the legitimate economy, so we are trying to take that away from the criminal gangs. Of course, it's up to those gangs whether they want to reform themselves into legitimate businesses and start playing by the rules, but we think it'd be safer for everyone if it was regulated in the public domain, out in the open. And, you know, you've talked about taxes earlier. If we could tax cannabis, then that would mean, you know, we could surely reduce tax in other areas.
Well, it seems like every single measurement the government has been taking during my lifetime of 29 years has been a band-aid solution to solve a problem that can't be solved by those means. Cannabis, on the other hand, seems to be something that can have longevity and solve in a very real way nearly every industrialized societal problem we have today, from any of the health problems that we have, from poisoning our environment to cleaning the environment itself up, and everything is rescinded from those two elements.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. Like, just looking at the medical benefits that could come from allowing cannabis, we know that people who have cancer are using cannabis to treat them, their condition. We know that people with epilepsy are having wonderful results from cannabis, where their seizures are stopping. And, you know, there's actually so many different illnesses and injuries that can be treated by medical marijuana that we really need to allow the science to take place. There needs to be more clinical studies, because with the law, they've only been able to study medical marijuana on rats. They haven't been able to do proper human trials, even though we know from the anecdotal evidence that it can cure or treat, you know, hundreds of different conditions.
And we also know from anecdotal evidence that if they were to do human trials, they would have no problem finding subjects.
That's true. There's plenty of volunteers who would, you know, test the effects of cannabis, and you know, they would be more than willing.
You know, I mean, look, if you ever want a science project that will have an unlimited supply of test subjects, unlimited supply, okay, you've got one right here. And talking about unlimited supply, thinking about the medical benefits, we're going through Rick Simpson, who I've had on the show a number of times. This is the thing about cannabis that he's discovered. In its purest form, in the high potency, pure THC hemp oil medical grade, you can cure pretty much anything. Whether it's cancer, lesions, a bad back, depression, liver failure, kidney anything.
It's amazing what Rick Simpson's been doing, and he's seems to have had a huge amount of success, and he's particularly become known for his claims about curing cancer. And I mean, some people you know, don't make those blanket statements about curing, because there's quite a few different types of cancer out there, but he really does seem to have the anecdotal evidence to show a lot of these people have recovered, even from terminal cancer. And it just shows you how medicinal the cannabis plant is, especially when you concentrate it all into the hash oil and just eat the hash oil like he's advising. And, you know, people like that, they're not going to sit around waiting for the science to confirm it. They know that it works, and they're just going to keep doing it. But, of course, he's been persecuted by the Canadian government. You know, he's had to spend time in Europe because of fear of arrest. It's really unfortunate that we're operating under these conditions where trying to save someone's life is actually a criminal offence.
in a world so full of madness, you know? That's the thing, we live an upside down world. In fact, have you ever played the opposite game, Julian, and you sat down and watched the news and played the opposite game? So every single thing that they say, you flip it round and it actually winds up being the truth.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes I sit down and watch the TV news and I can read between the lines of pretty much every news story that they're not telling the truth or the full truth. You know, there's an agenda out there and there's a dumbing down of the population through watching that sort of television news.
Apparently, Jeanette Saxby of the High Tea Cafe told me that the newspapers are written for the reading age of a 12-year-old. It's specifically for that, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a trained journalist myself. I used to work for the Truth newspaper, and you have to write every article using simple language that could basically be read by a 12-year-old. And, yeah, an interesting example, when I was a journalist, I wanted to write an article about bitcoins when they were worth $15 each. I wanted to write an investment column saying, good time to buy bitcoins, but because my editor thought that the reader wouldn't know what a bitcoin was, or the reader wasn't intelligent enough to understand that, it never got printed. So there is a sort of self-censorship in the media where people don't want to print anything that could be too complicated for the reader to understand.
Have you had a conversation with a really stupid person? You're telling them something that's very stupid, very simple, but quite profound, and they go blank? Is that what the editor's trying to avoid on a mass scale? So they're actually trying to curb their own conversation. Like, let's say you're talking to a person to person. This is the conversation of a newspaper to a reader. If you're trying to curb every single conversation you could ever have with anybody who wouldn't get what you were saying.
Yeah, well, they don't want to shock the reader. You can't expose that there's some sort of conspiracy going on to, you know, make their life, you know, a lot worse, and they like to think that everything's normal, everything's comfortable. You can't just shock them with what's really going on in the world, the fact that there's psychopaths who are in government, or, you know, whatever the reality may be. You know, we see a lot of warfare going on overseas, and, you know, we're not seeing the truth, are we, about the Ukraine crisis? You only have to watch RT News to see that there's a completely different narrative coming from the Russians as from the Western media. So it's good to get a range of sources before you make any conclusions.
Same way as making a Subway sandwich, it pays to have a number of different sources.
That's right.
The other element here, in terms of the international media and in terms the international sphere, is the recent legalization. Is it full legalization in Colorado and Washington State in the USA?
That's right. Especially in Colorado, they've got full legalization. So people are allowed to grow it at home. They're allowed to buy it at a dispensary. And, you know, they can get a medical prescription if they want, but or they can just do it for recreational reasons. And, yeah, I think in Washington State, people are allowed to grow it, but they can't actually buy it in the shops, so it's not quite full legalization there. But it seems to be booming in Denver. You know, there's just millions and millions of dollars coming in every week, if not every day, to these dispensaries. And the tax revenue is going to be over $100 million in the first year for the state of Colorado. So it's a huge economy, that's for sure.
Well, I think the statistics were quite stark. It was like on the very first day of legalization, the state made $1 million in tax revenue alone.
Yeah, there were queues of people coming out of down the street, you know, to buy cannabis on the first day. It was quite a historical moment for a lot of people to buy their first legal cannabis, and a lot of people had predicted that when it got legalized, there would be a huge amount of supply and that the price of cannabis would drop. But we saw the opposite happen. We saw that in Colorado, the price of weed doubled when they legalized it because there was so much demand and not enough supply.
Well, I think that's what happens, is because people didn't want to perhaps go see their regular dealer because it was the week that they could buy weed legally, you know, that kind of thing. And all of a sudden, all the suppliers that had access to legal weed had to go to all the previously illegal growers for it, maybe.
Yeah.
Who weren't willing to part with their weed for a small price. So here's the thing. If full legalization happens, it starts being good right away, but also you've got that kind of growing pain while the old illegal market gradually kind of loses its grip.
I'm sure that the legal market will increase its supply and that, you know, there'll be less reliance on the black market. But there's obviously going to be a transition period. And you know, with these $1 million a day of sales, that is only through about 20 or 30 existing dispensaries.
That's not $1 million in sales. That's $1 million just in tax revenue.
Yeah, but that's just from about 30 or 40 dispensaries. There's going to be a hell of a lot more dispensaries opening up soon. They're still really implementing the law. It's still early days. And they're hoping that in a few years, they're going to be able to make $1 billion a year off this industry.
As opposed to spending $1 billion a year for the DEA. Oh, wait, in fact, how much is the DEA? And here's another thing. Speaking of which, we're talking about America quite a bit here, considering we're New Zealanders and we're talking about cannabis law reform here in New Zealand. America's where all this stuff kind of came from. They've kind of proven to be the examples to look at.
That's right. I mean, the US has started cannabis prohibition. We've seen Nixon launching the war on drugs, and they've really exported the war on drugs around the world. They've pushed it into the United Nations framework and getting all the other countries in the world to ban cannabis, but then they turn around and start legalizing it in some of their own states. So that's why a lot of people are looking to the US, because if they can't maintain cannabis prohibition there, then the rest of the world shouldn't be obliged to.
How is the New Zealand political scene reacting to the legalization of cannabis in, say, Colorado? Has this been brought up in front of the media or made a big deal of? Because you would think that there'd be a huge hubbub about it, because whenever that kind of thing happens, that's actually huge news, and it does provide political pressure and ammunition upon the prohibitionists.
Yeah, I think that the media in particular in New Zealand is really picking up the cannabis issue. There's been a lot of attention recently about what's happening in Colorado and in California with the medical. And, you know, there's a lot of interest over here, but the politicians are still very reluctant. They still don't believe that the public is on side enough for them to just come out pro-cannabis. So I think more pressure still needs to be applied to the politicians over this. And, of course, the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party is the only party really dedicated to legalising it. So we think that, you know, the issue's not going to go away unless we get into Parliament.
Well, see, and even then, the issue will be stymied and stifled, and there's all these parliamentary rules and regulations. I think the system is broken, Julian. I think that even if a good apple gets in there, it only takes them a while to realise that they're part of a bad barrel. Like, you saw what happened to Nandor Tanjos with his valedictorian speech. He took out a ball-peen hammer out of his suit jacket and smashed his watch on his desk in front of Parliament after his speech was finished, because he was sick of the schedules and all the BS that he had to be put through, not to mention being surveilled by SIS, which, incidentally, the Queen has everybody who's a member of Parliament surveilled and checked out.
Yeah, you may well be right about it being, you know, a lost cause. Of course, you know.
There's no such thing as a lost cause, because any action you take has a reaction. I'm just worried more about, not only does the cannabis laws need reforming, but the methodology by which laws and elections are done in this country, and who finances the financiers and whatnot. Everything needs to be overhauled and redone. I mean, the system's broke. We should fix it.
Yeah, well, just yesterday I was talking to the Electoral Commission about election funding, and it's interesting that the main parties, Labor and National, get over $1 million of taxpayer funding just given to them, whereas the smaller parties are going to have about 20,000. So, you know, they're already at an advantage, these big parties. But our plan, if we could get into Parliament, our plan would be to try and hold the balance of power, which means that you sit in that centre ground between the left and the right wing where you can actually try and play them off against each other. And if we could be in a position where we could negotiate with Labor and National and say we'll form a coalition with whichever party embraces cannabis law reform, then we can really just try and just force the government to do it, not really expect them to do it through their own goodwill.
Well, you know, Julian, I can see you sitting there in Parliament gleefully rubbing your hands together as the National and Labor Party are fawning all over themselves and attacking each other just to get your hand in coalition marriage, you know, and you'll be sitting there just rubbing your hands together. Dance, puppets, dance!
Oh, it would be good, eh? I mean, we've seen Winston Peters do a similar thing back in 96, you know, when he took 6 weeks to negotiate between both sides of the house.
And, you know, Winston's got a lot of experience. He's been in there a long time.
But this is going to be a really interesting election, and I mean, there is every chance that John Key could retain in power, and, you know, it leaves us with the situation of, you know, are these people ever going to move on the cannabis issue? You know, we're going to be negotiating potentially with Tony Ryle, someone who hasn't shown much support so far. So hopefully the overseas evidence will start impacting on New Zealand.
Well, it's amazing in a digital age with information that can come at you in an instant that it still takes a government bureaucrat years to hear reason. Julian Crawford from the ALCP, Aotearoa Legalise Cannabis Party, is my guest. This episode is sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn, with the links on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Also, Blue Shields are back up for sale. And don't forget to go and see the Wagga Wagga Gourmet Soap Kitchen. God damn, that stuff is fantastic. You know, without it, I smell like a yak. It's terrible. Absolutely terrible. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you smell anywhere.
Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energies, cause none of them can stop all the thoughts. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just the part of it, but we've got to fulfill Jabu. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom?
Ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood doesn't go ahead, make my news. Now, my very special guest is Julian Crawford from the ALCP, not to be confused with the ALLCP? Or was it the African American Defense Coalition? That's not you guys, is it? Anyway, in their defense, synthetics, that's what we're talking about here. It's my argument, and I wanted to get your take on this, Julian, as well. There's two elements to this equation. Number one, I see, ironically, people out there not protesting to legalize cannabis, but to ban synthetic alternatives to cannabis, which they would smoke anyway. And the other side is, if you wanted the synthetic cannabis to go away, you could just legalize regular cannabis, because why would people buy the fake thing when they can grow the real thing for free?
That's right. Yeah, I absolutely agree that we're seeing all these protests of people wanting to ban them and get rid of synthetic cannabis by dealing with the supply side. But it's really the demand that could be tackled if we legalise natural cannabis.
What if ALCP sort of coalition with these people and you can have a combined platform, ban synthetics by legalising weed?
Yeah, I mean, we encourage people who are in this ban synthetics lobby to actually vote for legalising weed, because that's going to take the majority of demand away from them. The only reason that people are buying synthetic cannabis in the first place is because they want something that mimics cannabis without actually having to break the law. You know, a lot of people, like to be able to buy it legally. There's obviously a lot of popularity for the stuff.
Well, here's the other unfortunate business. What about those poor people who work for a living and get piss tested regularly, who can't do it, even if it's their birthday?
Well, that's what we're hearing, that a lot of people have moved from natural cannabis to synthetics so they can avoid workplace drug testing. You know, that's, if you're smoking the natural stuff, you can lose your job. But if you go and smoke this synthetic stuff that's more harmful, you're going to be able to pass the drug test. And it's really,
Also, I've heard an element has actually given to pure methamphetamine use, because it's only detectable in the body system for a number of days or something.
Well, cannabis is going to stay in your system for up to a month, but most hard drugs are going to pass through within a few days. So it really is the natural cannabis users that are most disadvantaged by workplace drug testing.
Well, and cannabis users are the majority of illegal drug users, am I correct? In the United States, what was it? Heard a statistic, 96 or 2006? I forget. They said something like 87% of illegal drug users only use cannabis. And it occurred to me a very important thought. The only reason why harder drugs are actually available really at all is because of the cannabis illegality to a large degree, because you get people in, everybody smokes weed, and you go, oh, bro, I'm getting some pills next week. Oh, really? Sweet as, man, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, when young people are getting told that cannabis is really bad and then they find out for themselves that they were lied to about cannabis, they might go on to the next drug and think, oh, this is going to be harmless as well, and not realise that these other drugs are quite dangerous.
Which is why government needs to regulate education about drug use. I mean, I don't think a entire prohibitionist society view of drug use is a good idea. I think that a safety and responsibility view of drug use. Are you doing too much? Lay back on that stuff, brother. Here's a support program. Or are you too young? That stuff's going to mess you up for life, mate. Wait a few years. These kind of approaches.
Well, it's interesting to compare the education on drugs with sexual education, because we don't have schools telling the kids just to abstain from sex and just never try it. You know, they're saying at some point you're going to be doing it, you need to know what it's all about. They should have the same approach to drugs. They shouldn't say, just never do drugs. They should say, well, there's a good chance that you're going to try drugs. So if you do, this is the safest way to do it, and these are the safest ones to try. There's no point pretending that an abstinence model of education is going to be any use these days.
Yeah, see, me personally, I thought something that would actually be really good to help curb the drinking culture in this country is to actually teach kids how to drink at school, like responsibly. Like, you know how you got like a 50-minute period or something? During that, you actually learn what alcohol is, what effects it has on the body, and you do a taste testing on that day of a wine or a beer or something.
Yeah, I mean, we know that other countries over in Europe and stuff have much more responsible drinking cultures, and they let children drink a small amount of alcohol from a young age. Whereas here we seem to have this culture of binge drinking that once you get to a certain age, you're expected to just go out and get blind drunk. And it's basically, you know, condoned by people's parents to go and get wasted on alcohol. But, you know, there's, you know, a lot of safer substances out there than alcohol, but they're banned. It's just a crazy situation to be in.
And it's the problem as well, is because people then hear a conversation like this and it's like, oh my God, do you want to give alcohol and drugs to kids? No, we're not saying that. We're saying if you actually want people to grow up in a society where they don't overdo it, and if they do, everybody else pulls them up about it and helps them to get better, then this is the approach you have to take. Unfortunately, this is what history shows us, is that everything drives human beings to want what they can't have. So if you want people to destroy them with drugs, tell them that they can't have them.
Well, if you look over at the Netherlands, where cannabis has been legal for decades, they have actually the lowest rate of teen cannabis use because there's not that whole rebellious aspect to using it, and there's a lot of drug education where the teenagers are actually learning that it's not cool just to do drugs, you know, that you can make that choice when you're an adult, but there's very, you know, low number of teenagers in Holland using cannabis, even though it's legally available.
When it was illegal, a number of people dropped from 1 in 7 to 1 in 21. So about a third of people that used to smoke continued to smoke. And when they were asked, a lot of these respondents in the surveys, why they stopped smoking, predominantly the answer was that their social circles changed. Because smoking cannabis was no longer a criminal activity, they would no longer keep up friendships that they had to maintain just so that they would smoke cannabis together. You know, hey, bro, what's up? Yeah, let's have a joint and what have you. You do it all the time just because it's illegal and you never know when you might have some more. But when it's freely available, you realize, I don't actually have anything in common with that person.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you shouldn't have to associate with undesirable people just to get some cannabis.
But you do from time to time.
You do what you have to do, you know, because some people, particularly with the synthetics, they're going to have a lot of withdrawal problems now that we're seeing a ban come in. And there's going to be a lot of people turning to the black market to get natural cannabis, you know, from the tinny houses. And, you know, government policy is really driving people into the black market. That's the unfortunate situation. We just wish that it could be regulated and this whole problem dealt with in the first place.
Who benefits? Who benefits from this drug war?
Well, the police certainly get a lot of funding for their drug war activities. You've got the prisons, the private prison industry, and then you've got pharmaceutical companies. We already know that pharmaceutical companies hold patents on synthetic cannabis products. Some of the products already available are owned by pharmaceutical companies.
What powers of lobbying do international interests like prisons, pharmaceutical companies, etc. have on a government?
Well, they have huge lobbying power. They, you know, will be talking directly to the ministers. We've seen the likes of Serco come in and get big government contracts for running prisons. And it's in their interests to actually have, you know, a lot of people in prison. Otherwise, they're going to go out of business. So they're going to lobby the government to keep laws in place which create lots of criminals. If you sort of take these 400,000 regular cannabis users and suddenly say they're not criminals, then you're probably going to end up with less people being in jail. So they're very powerful vested interests that we're up against. And, you know, across many industries, alcohol, tobacco, pharmaceuticals, and, you know, the list goes on.
Is it not illegal to persecute a particular sect of people for profit?
Well, you would think it would be, wouldn't you? The every time the police arrest someone for cannabis, they are stealing that person's medicine.
And those people that are being stolen from are generally Māori as well.
Yeah, yeah. We know that the war on drugs is primarily a racist policy. It was brought in initially to target Chinese when they banned opium, and they've banned cannabis to target Mexicans, Negroes, and Maori. You know, it's really, usually it's the indigenous or the ethnic populations which are being unjustly targeted by these racist laws.
Well, in terms of the racist policy, let's think about this buzzword, racism. At the end of the day, there's only one race. It's called the human race, and we're all brothers and sisters in it. That's my belief, you know. And some people don't believe that, though. They believe that some races are lesser than others, right? And this is why people don't understand it, and they don't understand the compulsion of psychopaths, because they can't think that way. They can't think with unnecessary hate, malice, and cruelty against everything that is good and wholesome and joyous. Okay? You can't think like that, can you, ladies and gentlemen? The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing people he didn't exist. Now you can't even think like the devil, which means he's freaking everywhere. I see it all over the media, man. And I don't even watch the media, and the little trickles and things that I come through. It all just screams to me, it's the devil. He's trying to take over my mind and my country. Oh dear God, no! You know, that's the sort of religious connotation. But the end result is pretty much the same. There's pretty evil scumbaggery involved here, isn't it? In every sector of society, there's just no end to the scumbaggery. It's in the courts, it's in the media, it's, oh my God, the lawyers, the doctors, the ministers, the assistants and associates, the prime ministers, the heads of the NGOs, these organizations, these lobby groups, the police commissioners, every single fabric of society is woven together in this psychopathic control grid of utter fractal scumbaggery that threatens to penetrate all forms of goodness in the asshole.
Yeah, yes. Well, I agree with what you're saying about the human race. We're all related to each other genetically, and that, you know, our similarities are a lot greater than our differences. So there's really no need for these racist-based politics. We don't need to have policies that, you know, really turn one race into an underclass. And just to give an example, when you watch the Olympics or the Winter Olympics, you can see that athletes from any country can win any event. That, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're Asian, African, Arab, or Caucasian. We all have very similar athletic abilities when it comes down to it. So, you know, I don't think we should be looking at the Māori as an underclass and trying to put them in prison disproportionately and, you know, trying to bring this neo-colonial approach to indigenous races. It's terrible. And, of course, you know, people have identified the problem of Māori being locked up in prison, but no one has come up with any solution apart from what we're saying, and that the cannabis issue has to be resolved before the race problems are going to be resolved.
How about the judges work on this little statistic? How about you stop being 9 times more likely to sending a Maori guy to jail than a white guy for the same crime? All right. How about you have a look at the statistics about 50% of the prison population being Maori when Maori are only 15% of the population? Okay? It's targeted. It's specific. Something's being done with surgical precision here, to my mind.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's not just the judges in the courtroom. The fact that the police are arresting more Maori, they're targeting these races just using stereotypes to actually target people for arrest. If you're a middle, upper-class white person, you're very unlikely to even be arrested for cannabis. You could just be given a warning. But if you're coming from a low socioeconomic background, you're a Maori or a Pacific Islander, you could easily just get locked up for the same offence.
Boom. You got a willing population of slaves. And this is, I think, what it's all heading to in politics under Agenda 21 and all of these globalist advances. Basically, they want to turn human beings that are free and independent into slaves that are dependent. All right? So that it's kind of like a meat grinder. People go in one end and meat comes out the other. From cradle to grave, we all get taken care of by the state. Taken care of in the mafia sense of the word, like I'm going to take care of him.
Yeah, well, if you look at Agenda 21, it's actually all based on controlling resources and this idea that there's a scarcity of resources, so we need to control them and just allocate a little bit, and you'll only be able to drive your car on certain days of the week, and you have to use less water and all of this stuff. But when we talk about the industrial hemp industry, we're talking about creating lots of new resources. So all of a sudden, we're a threat to the idea of scarcity. We can produce biofuel from hemp, so we can keep driving our cars every day. We can, produce all of the resources we need.
May I make a point on the biofuel there? Those who have been worried about peak oil and so on and so forth have been saying that biofuel from, say, corn and whatnot is a really bad idea because it actually makes almost 10 calories of petroleum chemicals in order to produce 1 calorie of biofuel. But hemp not only doesn't need those petroleum products in order to be produced, and in a lot of ways doesn't need them to be harvested to any great extent because you can recycle the oils and what have you, but it produces 4 times as much biofuel per hectare than anything else anyway.
Yeah, I think the main concern with biofuels is that the land usage is going to be used to make fuels that could be used for making food.
With the hemp plant, it produces seeds and food and everything at the same time as producing the matter for the biofuel. So you've got everything you need in the same crop anyway. In fact, it's a multi-purpose crop. You wouldn't just be planting crops for one purpose. You could basically turn that crop into anything as much as you need for that day. Who knows? It could be prefab, made to order. Yeah.
That's right, for sure. Like, not only are you producing at least 4 times the amount of biomass of these other crops, you're producing your food and your fuel at the same time. You'd go through and harvest the seed and use the seed to make food products. And then you've got the rest of the plant, which can go into a biomass, into a composter, a digester, or into a catalytic converter where they turn the plant material into charcoal and the gases and liquid fuels get released and condensed through a distillation process. So you could literally chuck hemp into one end of a machine and have liquid fuel just dripping out the other.
You can make hemp plastics as well. On top of that, we have a inventor, Roy Harlow, who actually plays the show around the Hamilton and, in fact, across New Zealand now, come to think of it. He has invented a machine where you put plastic in one end and diesel comes out the other.
Yeah, well, we know that most of the plastic that we use today is made from diesel. It's made from these fossil fuels. So, you know, even if we stopped using our cars, we'd still need a hell of a lot of petroleum to make our plastic.
And it's not biodegradable.
No. It never biodegrades.
This is the problem. We're living in the age of oil. Everything's made of oil. Everything, you know, or some expenditure of it. We need something to replace that. Is there enough land? Is there enough resources in all the world to actually replace just the need for oil-based products alone with cannabis? I think it'd be a good start at the very least.
Yeah, I think there is enough land in the world to replace all of the petrochemical products. And the good thing about the hemp plastic is that it will biodegrade over time. You know, after a couple of years in the landfill, it's going to biodegrade. But we can still make sturdy products that are going to be useful to us now.
We could actually build up landmass in that regard, because imagine a landfill that's with trash, like let's say excess building materials or plastic bottles and old furniture and everything like that, with every stitch and fabric and fibre and plank and everything within all of that trash that's going in this landfill is actually made from hemp, which will biodegrade. That actually becomes new land. So we'd not only be producing biomass out of the sun, but we'd actually be, in essence, in a lot of ways, creating new room to live for future generations.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's only going to revitalise the soil, having hemp products breaking down. You know, they're going to act as natural fertilisers. So what could be a landfill now could actually be turned into productive land if we stop polluting, you know, with these other products.
Well, does ALCP also have an environmental policy in terms of reducing the toxins, poisons, etc. through the food chain that we're all exposed to?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we really like the idea of organic GE-free produce, and we want to promote more of that because we wouldn't want to smoke cannabis that was grown with heaps of chemicals, and we think the same should apply to our food, you know, these fruit and veggies. Really, we need to be getting the Roundup out of them, all of the pesticides and whatever toxic chemicals. They're a big part of the problem. And a lot of food today is grown on a mass homogenized scale. And it's ironically called the Green Revolution. But all of the fertilizer is, again, made from petroleum products.
So who controls the oil currently? Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, Queen Elizabeth of England, David Rockefeller of America, and a few other little conglomerates in there as well. All of these people are basically the worst globalist scum that the world's ever seen. It seems to me that the human race is bound in politics, not only upon issues like the cannabis issue, but at all sides, we've been divided and conquered by a psychopathic elite who basically own our way of life. They own the products that we consume every day, they own the supply chains, and they own our politicians. And it seems to me that if radical change is to happen, these influences have to be contested at the very least within the halls of parliament. I mean, is there anybody in the halls of parliament questioning the legitimacy of the Reserve Bank, which has the Rothschild family shield crest right behind its front doors?
I don't think any of the current MPs are challenging that paradigm. And it really shows who we're up against, the likes of the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, hugely powerful influences in the world. And it comes back to people being in denial, I think, about the fact that these people are running the world. We like to believe we live in a democracy. We like to think that we can influence the government in some small way. But in reality, we are going head-to-head against these powerful players on the world scene, and we've seen them throughout the Middle East trying to control these oil reserves, and they are trying to maintain the US dollar as the reserve currency by forcing countries to trade in oil for US dollars, and they don't want anything that's going to threaten that paradigm. So the idea of producing, you know, thousands of gallons of biofuel is not going to go down too well with some of these people. So, you know, we really have to try and push ahead with the solutions, and the cannabis issue is just one example of how we've got to stand up against the Rockefellers, Rothschilds, what have you. But if we can't win this issue, then, you know, we know that our rights and freedoms have already been taken away.
Well, if you're being divided and conquered and attacked on every front by your enemy, it seems only logical to resist them in every single way possible. You know, why not legalize cannabis would be the answer. We already know the why we should. We'll be right back after the break with Julian Crawford from ALCP. Ladies and gentlemen, don't you go anywhere.
You can talk the talk, but will you walk the walk, or will you bring us comfort, or will you bring us comfort? Politician, can you make a right decision for all of us, for all of us? Politician, can you make a right
segment here of the Vinny Eastwood Show. This episode is sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in Newland. You can check out the banner on the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. Also check out the Blue Shield little EMF protection devices. They're quite lovely. And the Gourmet Soap Kitchen as well. And as always, most of the revenue, in fact, come to think of it, pretty much all the revenue to support this show comes from donations from listeners like you, ladies and gentlemen. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate or subscribe to put in a regular donation, say $5 a month or something of that nature. It just keeps all the bills paid so we can just keep interviewing all the people that the media will basically shut out, and even if they do interview them, we'll give them a couple of seconds of airtime. An audio nibble, it's not enough information to base decisions that are going to affect the future of your country, ladies and gentlemen. You can't do short form interviews with politicians, researchers, guests, and issues and expect to have a vastly more informed view. It's not possible. The show that I'm doing here is absolutely necessary for people to wake up even further than they already have. If you're not waking up, you probably won't have even found the show yet. But now that you're here, because you're listening to so many diverse voices, thoughts, ideas, and people, and accents, and subject matters, you are becoming more profoundly woken up than you may have ever been in your life. That is the reason why I do it. I do that for me. You just get to come along for the ride. If you want the ride to stop, don't donate. Right? At the moment, I'm in quite desperate financial straits, so it'd be in my best interest, maybe and yours, to give us a little bit of coin. Probably like about $1,000 within the next week would be very nice. Anyway, back to my guest. Julianne Crawford has been patiently sitting in the background there. Welcome back.
Yeah, cheers for having me on the show. It's been good.
All right. I hope you've enjoyed yourself.
Yep.
Yep. Sounds real enthusiastic there. You sound like you need to go, bro.
Well, we do have a lot of events coming up that if people want to get involved in, of course, J-Day being the main one. The annual public smoke up in New Zealand throughout the country. People have had enough of the cannabis laws getting out on the street and actually just defying the law publicly. So, yeah, it's a good opportunity for people to come out and meet each other who are interested in the cannabis culture.
What are some of the details of that? Where can people get more info?
You can check out our website, alcp.org.nz, and all the main centres are holding J-Day. It's going to be in Albert Park up in Auckland, Frank Kitts Park in Wellington, Bridge of Remembrance in Christchurch, and in the Octagon in Dunedin. And that's on the 3rd of May at midday.
I find it ironic that they're going to have a Bridge of Remembrance, because a whole lot of stoners won't remember it.
Well, they might not remember what it looked like before the earthquake. I think it's that part of Christchurch is still under repairs, of course.
Somebody told me once, like, I don't know whether he was serious or just joking or something, but he was talking about this research with cannabis in the brain. And what they found was that it increases your IQ with cannabis use, but it's at the expense of your short-term memory. So you would have these really brilliant thoughts, but forget that you had them.
Yeah, well, it's interesting what cannabis does to the brain is that usually when your neurons are firing, there's a short pause between the neurons firing. But when you smoke cannabis, you can actually have a continuous neuron firing, so your thoughts are running wild. But that can also cause you to sort of forget stuff that's happening around you because you are too busy thinking about something else. But having said that, people do smoke cannabis and go out and drive their cars and perform all of their usual functions. So the impairment is nowhere near what we're seeing with alcohol and other drugs.
Well, and also, I wonder what the problem is with drink driving and what have you, and all of these speeding tickets and what have you. I just think that if you've hurt somebody, you know, or if you're actually doing it dangerously and whatnot, you know, you're endangering private property, then sure, you can be pulled up. But if you're a little bit over the limit, but you're driving slowly and what have you, you make it home all right, what's the problem? I think if there's no victim, there's no crime. But people have a precautionary approach to this, which means nobody can even go out and even have so much as a drink soon enough in the future and be able to drive home. They're talking about lowering the limit, you know, so you can't even have a glass of wine with dinner out with your friends and be able to drive home.
Yeah, it's definitely going that way. I mean, it would be better if, you know, the law was based on actual harm, because with cannabis there's no victim, there's no one actually being harmed at all, yet it's still treated as a crime. And like you say, this precautionary approach is becoming more and more common, where people are saying, oh, what if something goes wrong, we need to sort of wrap everyone in cotton wool. But it's taking away their individual responsibility at the same time.
And as a result, people become, in general, less responsible.
Yeah. And I mean, we've got this mentality that if you crash your car or something, then some insurance company's just going to pay for it. You know, it's not going to cost you out of your own pocket. And government has its own insurance schemes and ACC and all this. And a lot of it is just saying, look, the state will look after you. You don't need to be taking personal responsibility, because we don't trust you to look after yourself anyway. And slowly but surely, our rights and liberties are being taken away. You know, we're seeing that with tobacco as well, that there's a move to ban tobacco in New Zealand by 2025.
Well, first they tell you that you can't take care of yourself, and over a period of time, with progressive legislation, they make taking care of yourself illegal.
Well, they like to make the decisions for you, what's in your best interest. And, you know, we see the education system is run by the state, and, you know, they expect you to be a productive worker, and they don't see cannabis as fitting into their view of the economy, which is unfortunate, because there's a lot of professional people out there who do smoke cannabis that want to be having successful careers, and we feel like we're being discriminated against.
When was the last time there was a US president elected that hadn't had weed at some point in their life? It might have been Nixon.
Probably, you know, because in my lifetime, most of the US presidents have admitted to smoking cannabis, you know.
I reckon they should all go to jail. Like, you know what would make it fair? Here's what would make it fair. And I've done this to a crowd of people before, Julian, okay?
Yeah.
Raise your hand if you know somebody, anybody, that has ever used cannabis. Virtually everybody raises their hand, you know. Okay, put your hands down. Now, raise your hand if you want to see any of those people go to jail.
Yeah.
Nobody raises their hand. Unless there's like one guy. And he goes, yeah, I reckon you should be sent to jail. And this happened in front of a crowd of people too. And everybody laughed. And I go, yeah, see, now, isn't it funny, sir, that you're the only person that agrees with the law, and yet the law exists against everybody's will here to protect the people they love from the law?
Yeah, and we saw on Campbell Live the other day, they did a poll on whether people supported decriminalising cannabis for personal use. And they were really surprised when 84% were in favour of it, because it just shows that the public doesn't want cannabis prohibition. The only reason it's there is because our politicians are being dictated to by foreign interests, you know, particularly coming from the US and the United Nations. So what does that tell you about New Zealand's sovereignty? It's already non-existent if the will of the public is ignored in a democratic situation.
It's a sham marriage.
Oh, yes. I mean, they've got a lot of people, you know, out there voting these politicians in, but is it really in their best interest to be voting them back into power every 3 years? We really think that the public should look at some of the minor parties and some of the alternative options that aren't in Parliament at the moment, because we could be a lot better off.
Well, I think that the reason why democracy, i.e. in Latin translation, mob rule, is failing the mob, is because it's quite easy to control a mob using mob control techniques. All right? And I think that if the mob wants to take control of their controllers, you need direct democracy, which means every bit of legislation should be voted on by the people as it comes up. You know, we've got email. We've got Skype, we've got Facebook forums, we've got all sorts of ways for people to calibrate and get informed and put their views across to their government on a daily basis about what should be being done, don't we? We've got the technology. Why don't we do that? Because I know for a fact that every single person I've ever looked up to in my entire life, no matter how much I idolize them, has disappointed me. Because I put across perfection that didn't exist in my thoughts about them. And because they're human, they're imperfect, and they'll always fall short of your expectations. This is the reason why I don't like the whole idea, no offense, Julian, of having politicians represent an inordinate amount of people in such of just one person's mind. Why can't everybody's mind be representation of themselves? Why can't they all have a voice? And the answer is, we're all too busy working to survive because we're being taxed too much to be able to survive and also have free time to think about stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy because you'd think that the politicians should be working for us, working for the public, but when the public states its opinion and the politicians don't like that opinion, they'll just readily ignore it. And we've seen that with a number of citizens-initiated referendums where the public has voted overwhelmingly for a certain course of action, and then the Prime Minister has just turned around and said, no, we're not going to follow that recommendation. So I guess, like you say, we need to have some sort of binding referendum if it's going to make a difference, but I doubt the government is ever going to be willing to implement binding referendums.
Well, see, even then, you come up with a situation like they've gotten, what was it, is it Sweden or Austria that has the binding referendum? But apparently, see, again, the mob mentality still persists within crowds of people. They become easily manipulated, far too easy to control. And so even with binding referenda, you'll get people manipulating the mob into voting for something that is against their interest, just the same way they always have. It's a silk hand and cased in an iron glove.
Yeah, I mean, that's the trouble these days, that you've got like television and other means of widespread manipulation of the public opinion. And I guess, you know, people have to realise that they are susceptible to having their opinion manipulated.
Hey, wouldn't that be an ironic thing to teach every child in New Zealand public schools about how authority figures tend to manipulate you? And there's an authority figure in the teacher telling them this.
Well, I think there's a deliberate agenda to actually dumb people down, because intelligent people are actually a threat to the system. And with this Agenda 21 stuff, there's this idea that if we get too rich, we're going to consume too much, that we're going to have, you know, big mansions, and we're going to have five cars and all this, and that if we keep people less educated, they're less likely to become rich and they're less likely to consume lots of resources. And you know, I think it's a scary prospect that we have a country that's deliberately being miseducated or not educated in the first place.
Well, it occurs to me that there is a way through all of this. I just don't know what it is. And so the next thing that occurs to me is, how do I cope with knowing how messed up stuff is and work against it to some degree without getting bogged down, depressed about it and what have you? Because, you know, it sometimes feels like you're playing against a rigged game.
Yeah, well, I mean, you certainly have to pick your battles when you're in politics, because if you try and, you know, fix every single problem, you're probably going to be banging your head against a brick wall and not necessarily getting anywhere. But the other thing that people can do is just work around the system and try and lead by example, and just in their own private life, try and achieve the way of life that they think other people should aspire to. There's plenty of ways that we could be growing the economy without hurting the environment at the same time.
You know, in fact, something occurred to me about what you were saying right there, is that I'm really starting to get pretty angry at the Green Party.
Well, the Green Party, they claim to be a sort of grassroots movement representing different activist groups, and including the cannabis activists. But once these groups get absorbed into the green movement, they sort of get neutralised and never really get represented properly. And you realise that the Greens aren't actually grassroots. They're taking their instructions from their foreign powers. And, you know, I think they're every bit part of the establishment as the Labour and National Party are. So they've become very mainstream, and that's why they're willing to compromise on some of their previous principles.
And I think that's what's happened. We've come from first past the post, which is one tyrannical scumbaggery party or a different tyrannical scumbaggery party, all both financed by foreign bankers and implementing UN and World Bank agendas upon New Zealand and subjugating its people and destroying its economy and eroding our freedoms. And now with MMP, we have evolved into a three-plus party state, with the three main parties being the exact same, more or less, in every way. You read their environment policy of the Greens, Labour, and National. All the words are pretty much lifted from Agenda 21. It's the same freaking thing. All these guys are the three main parties. These are what I'm thinking. Like the other rogue elements, you know, Mana and New Zealand First. I think New Zealand First has been rogue from day one.
Yeah.
Winston, I love him. It was the reason I voted for this Winston in the last election, mind you, Julian, is because he called the earthquake recovery minister the corpulent Jerry Brownlee. He called him an illiterate woodshop teacher.
Yeah.
It was the first time he got kicked out of the house after being elected back into it.
You've got to love Winston and stuff, but it's interesting that you say that the National Party is going down the same road as these left-wing parties, and we've seen Jerry Brownlee bring in what I would consider fascist legislation in Christchurch, where he's allowed to suspend any New Zealand law except the Bill of Rights when it comes to rebuilding Christchurch, and that, you know, with the rebuild in Christchurch, we're seeing all of these internationalist principles being applied in the Christchurch CBD rebuild, you know, the likes of smart meters on every house and, you know, cameras everywhere and biometrics.
Really? So they're going to turn this into the little prison city, are they? Because I've just heard rumblings. I know we're pressed for time and you need to go, that we're going to basically have our two megacities, like under Agenda 21, more or less, the settlement for human habitation will be in settlement zones, like there's little dots on the map. Everything else, more or less, is off limits or highly restricted to human activity. So that'll be more or less the whole country, except for more or less Christchurch and Auckland, right? Everything else will be off limits. This is over time, of course.
Yeah, it's obviously going to be brought in over time, but gradually they're moving more and more people to live in urban areas. And we've heard that the mayor of Auckland wants to double the population of Auckland to at least 2 million people, but within the same existing boundaries of the CBD. They don't want to expand the city outwards. They just want to have more people living within a confined space. And I can't really understand it myself that they think that if people live in the cities and just walk everywhere, then there's going to be less environmental problems. But I would have thought that having people living on lifestyle blocks out in the bush, growing a bit of fruit and veggies and hemp, that would be more environmentally friendly than living in the city. But they're worried that people are going to commute from the countryside to the city too often, so they don't want people living out in remote areas.
And so they'll eventually make living in those remote areas illegal. Sorry, eminent domain or something that sounds like that. The government's going to preeminently acquire your land that you've been living on for generations and what have you, and now you have to go and live in a slave block in 140 square feet of apartment. 140 square feet? That's like a 1.5 bedroom apartment. I've got 4 kids. I know. Sorry, mate. Regulations. You're going to have to work it out somehow. Maybe your youngest can sleep on the dish rack.
Yeah, let's hope it doesn't get too bad, but, you know, the government is going down a dangerous path that, you know, could be quite a concern in the future.
I think it'd be hilarious, you know. It'd be like Judge Dredd. It'd be fantastic, you know. Incidentally, under the food bill, and I know you've got to go, we'll be off here in a second. In the food bill, there's actually provisions where armed private security can come onto your property, confiscate your vegetables if they're not like food bill approved and what have you, you know, like if they're heirloom, non-genetically modified, non-Monsanto, you know. And not only can they be armed, but they're also, and here's the kicker, immune from any form of criminal prosecution.
Oh, it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, we know that in New Zealand, the food authorities have already signed up for what's called Codex Alimentarius, which is just a, you know, a huge register of what will and won't be allowed. And the New Zealand food authorities have also basically merged their systems with the FDA in the US, that New Zealand recognises everything that the Food and Drug Administration is saying, and it's part of our system. And these same food authorities are maintaining a ban on hemp food at the moment. They've removed all the hemp food from the shelves because the Australian authorities are still concerned about whether there might be THC in hemp food, even though there is none in it.
There's even THC in breast milk. And a woman was actually arrested because they found some of her breast milk had THC in it.
I was amazed that woman actually pleaded guilty, because it would have been a good court case to say not guilty, Your Honour. You know, that was, you know, there's no proof that the baby was getting high.
I fed my baby, but I didn't feed it from my left breast. Doo-doo-doo. Okay, thank you very much, Gillian Crawford. Final words of encouragement, wisdom for really disillusioned stoners out there who can't even be bothered getting off of their ass and voting ALCP. I've known a few of these people. It's disgusting.
Yeah, well, firstly, just want to thank you for having me on the show, Vinny. It's been a pleasure, and I just think that the election is a really big opportunity, and if people out there are just thinking they can't be bothered voting, then that's actually just making it easier for the current Prime Minister to stay in power. The current government will be able to stay in power with less votes if there's a low turnout. So I encourage you to get out there and vote. And if you're so disillusioned with all these other parties, why not just give your vote to the Aotearoa Legalised Cannabis Party? Because we're not following the same agenda as these parties. We're actively opposing what they're doing. So we support anyone who is disillusioned with politicians, and we've just got ordinary New Zealanders who are standing up to be our candidates, and we definitely are serious about getting into Parliament. So if we can get 5% of the party vote nationwide, we could end up with 5% of the MPs in Parliament. So I'd encourage people to get on the roll to vote, and, you know, try and use democracy to change things for the better, because if you don't vote, then things are probably just going to get worse.
Indeed. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.